Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today it's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so we're starting off with some rather depressing bird news this morning. It was a recent study that shows 29% decline in birds in North America. We're always talking about how dangerous it is to be a bird to begin with, but that's not good news.
Yeah. Good morning, everyone. Wah, wah.
Really?
Yeah.
I know.
Well, yes. Certainly this story has been going viral. I mean, everybody has covered this story, the Wall Street Journal, every major news outlet. And it's a little bit unusual in that they've, even before the paper got published, they created a website about it, 3 billion birds or something. I can't remember exactly what it is. So the authors are doing this big marketing effort about this study, and it's good. You know, whatever your criticisms of the study are, these are real problems. Birds are definitely declining, certain birds in particular especially. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And I think this is great in that it's bringing attention to all of these different reasons, whether it's neonicotinoid pesticides, you know, how you manage your properties, keeping your cats indoors, making bird-friendly windows. I mean, these are some of the big things that are causing the decline of certain birds. If you start to nitpick it a little bit and look at like the top 10 birds that declined, two of them we don't care about because they're not native and we've been wanting them to decline for years.
Which
sparrows and starlings are two of the top 10 birds that have declined, accounting for something like 15% of the decline. So just wipe that 15% away. That's good. We never wanted house sparrows or starlings in the first place. They were the ones that caused the decline of bluebirds and things like that.
You know, I just want to just jump in there. Starlings, I know they're not, but they really are beautiful birds. When you look at that black shimmery, you know.
Starlings are really cool. They're basically minor birds. They can talk if you were to raise one. And they are cool looking. They're just not native to North America.
No.
And I think both starlings and house sparrows are also declining in Europe, where they're native to. And I think it has to do with losing farmland.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of this has to do with losing farmland. Some of the birds that are declining are grassland birds that benefited from kind of old school farming where there'd be grassy areas and fallow fields and people don't farm like that anymore. Everything is these big monoculture farms where there's not a lot of room for wildlife, and that affects everything from birds to monarch butterflies. And so that's being reflected. You know, I wouldn't jump off a cliff over this report. I mean, these are some things that we've known about, and I think there are things we can do about some of these declines if we so choose. But I guess one of the grim things is that this doesn't even really account for climate change because I mean, it sort of does. That's happening in the background, presumably over the last 50 years. But that's going to get worse, and so fixing that is going to be one of the big ways to stem the tide of this decline of birds. And on top of all of these other things, like, you know, pesticides and cats and windows and things.
Right. So it feels to me like there's a lot of people interested in, you know, feeding birds. And maybe is that a helpful thing, or is that, I've kind of heard two schools of thought there, that feeding the birds is a good thing, and then I've heard feeding the birds is a bad thing.
Well, it can be both, you know, like most things, it's nuanced.
Yeah.
there are studies that have shown that it can benefit birds. It can increase winter survival of certain birds. Overall, it's not something birds need. It's something that we do for ourselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. We feed birds for us so we can bring them closer to our houses and enjoy them. And I do it, and it's a lot of fun. But it can also subject them to more window kills and more cats and things like that. And there's disease issues where you're crowding the birds together at the feeders. And if you're not cleaning them, that they're getting things like the conjunctivitis that house mm-hmm. finches get. So it's like most things in life, it's a mixed bag when you really look at it in detail. But, you know, if you do it right and are conscientious about it, it's the most common way that people enjoy birds. So it's hard to oppose it because It's how a lot of people get into birds and birding, and then mm-hmm. that can lead to other kind of conservation ethics and things like that. So I can't imagine myself coming down on against, you know, feeding the birds. I mean, I can't imagine stopping doing it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's rats now as the new
reason
to be against feeding birds.
Well, as you know, I stopped feeding them because of the rats. And I do feed them in a different way because, I have big gardens and I have a lot of, I still see the same birds. I just have to look for more carefully in the yard. You know, they're eating from, you know, the flowers and, you know, bushes and things that I have in the yard.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons for the rats. I mean, compost and trash and chicken, kind of backyard chicken farming. There's a lot of reasons that there are rats around. I think it's a little bit overblown in terms of the role of feeding backyard birds. But it's certainly a factor. And mm-hmm. you just, you know, if that's contributing, then take your feeders down at least for a while.
And see what happens. Yeah.
Yeah.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk any kind of critters you want. Doesn't have to be just birds.
All the critters.
All the critters. If you have questions or comments, feel free to give us a call. All right. Migration, this is like birders. This is like the World Series or something of birding, right? I mean, this is like everybody, you know, because you don't know what you're going to see. The birds are migrating and, right?
This is the great time of year. I mean, September is really good. And I really like October. At times it can be a little bit dead if things leave and then don't get replaced by other migrants. But October is a really exciting month. I mean, there are still some warblers around. Sparrow migration is really getting going. Raptors are migrating. It's easy to see falcons if you're out in the field. We had nice looks at a merlin just perched at the edge of the marsh at the sanctuary in Wellfleet yesterday. I was with some WCAI listeners yesterday. Did a nice little walk for a little pledge drive reward there. It was good to hang out with some listeners there at the sanctuary and do some birding. And we had lovely looks at this merlin just sitting there looking for birds to kill. It's an exciting time of year. Ducks are coming in from the north. Sea ducks are coming in. And then freshwater ducks will be migrating soon. There's just a lot going on. Yeah. And there's all kinds of potential to find interesting things. The last 5 days or so, we've had a western kingbird at the sanctuary in Wellfleet. And this is a species that shouldn't be here, but it turns up every year. Somewhere between 1 and 6 or 7 or something like that, western kingbirds end up on the Cape in any given fall. And they just go the wrong way. They should be flying to Mexico for the winter, but instead they end up on Cape Cod. And no one is exactly sure why. And it's been nice to have one at the sanctuary. It was still there this morning, I heard, for those still haven't seen it. And I'm sure there's other things out there. So people just need to get out there and go to your own local patches. Don't just go to the same place as everyone else birds. Find there's so many places that can hold interesting birds, especially this time of year. Find your local community garden, right? I've talked about these before. Most towns have a community garden somewhere, and they're just gold mines for birds this time of year because they tend to be sunny, they're weedy, you know, everything has kind of gone to seed. The edges are weedy, and there's a lot of weedy stuff in people's plots still. There's usually like a compost pile full of insects, and so they tend to hold birds. And you can find things like blue grosbeaks and clay-colored sparrows and dixisils. Some of these interesting October migrants that we hope to see are often not that hard to find at a community garden, and they're not big. You know, mm-hmm. it's not like some big wildlife refuge that you could spend hours and hours combing. It's a pretty limited space, and so you can bird it in the course of 45 minutes or so and find some interesting things. So find your local community garden, find your local gravel pit or something like that, like ugly, abandoned cranberry bogs are good, and any kind of weedy abandoned property can be good for birds in October.
Yeah, it's fun. Also, too, hearing you just kind of listening, and you can, you know, my grandson and I were in the garden yesterday afternoon, and we heard a cardinal call. We didn't see the cardinal, but we heard it. And we said, oh, listen to the cardinal. And he's actually really, he's better with the bird sounds than I am. He's four.
Well,
but you know, I've been hearing, you know, the screech owl. And for, I think last year or the year before, for a couple of years in a row, we had in like January and February, I was hearing the great horned owl. Yeah. So now I'm hearing this little screech owl, which got me thinking,
there he is.
This is what I'm hearing.
You brought him with you.
Yeah, I brought him with me. You know,
it's a great sound, isn't it?
Yeah, owls are just great.
This is my favorite part. Ready? It's my favorite part of the song.
Tell
eerie?
Us a little more about the screech owls.
I love that monotone
when do they,
trill.
When are they breeding and what are they doing? And I haven't heard them
what
all summer.
Doing?
I just heard them, I mean, just recently.
Well, first of all, they're super common and they're fine with the suburbs. They like the suburbs. Anywhere there's trees, there can be screech owls. Some have called them the most abundant raptor, meaning predatory bird in maybe North America, but Eastern screech owl is probably the most abundant raptor in the East. So they're small. They don't need huge territories. They are very much predatory. They're eating anything smaller than them, really. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons they're successful is they'll eat anything from moths and beetles to roosting songbirds and certainly rodents. So they'll really eat anything. They're cavity nesters, so they'll nest in like an old flicker cavity or rotting out tree. And as our forests get older, there's more and more of that. And so they're probably only increasing. They're already very common and probably only increasing. And I just love them. They're vocal. Mm. You know, they can be vocal year-round. You can call one in year-round.
Mm-hmm.
And I do most of my owling in the winter around the Christmas bird counts starting in mid-December. But I hear them, I feel like about once a month, I'll just be sitting in my house and I'll hear one in my neighborhood. And I'm really hoping they're going to check out my box that has only been occupied by stupid squirrels so far.
As a matter of fact, we have a caller who wonders what time of year to put the owl nest boxes up.
Any time of year, really, because it's going to take time. They're not going to just jump into your box as soon as you put it up. I mean, there are probably better times than others, like if you put it up during the winter, then they can find it before breeding season and be aware of it. That's the best time to do it if you're hoping to get owls in it, you know, next spring.
Mm-hmm.
But really, at any time of year, because typically it takes a while for an owl to occupy your box, and sometimes years or sometimes never, you know, certainly not a guaranteed thing. But if you put it in the right place, and there, you know, you can find these online or locally, they're about the same size as a wood duck box. So it's like a giant bluebird house with a bigger hole. And you can look up the dimensions that they're supposed to be. I can't remember offhand, but squirrels are going will get there first.
Yeah.
And different people deal with that different ways. I know somebody who just was going up every day and ripping the leaves out of the out of the box as the squirrels were putting them in there. And eventually, I think they won the battle and owls were able to get in there. But I've been a little lazier because it's kind of hard to get the ladder where I have mine. But twice I've heard one calling near mine, which has not been the case in the previous 3 years I've lived at this house. So in terms of hearing an owl right in our back trees there. And so,
when do the screech owls breed?
They breed in spring, everything else.
Yeah.
They're not like the big owl. They're not like great horned owls.
Start
nesting and they're paired up in January and start nesting. Yeah, by February they're on eggs.
Yeah. And what's the difference between the Western screech owl and the Eastern screech owl? I was visiting a friend in Napa a couple years ago.
Yeah,
and I heard it. I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, the Western screech owl has more of a bouncing ball call.
Mm-hmm.
And as you go south through North America into Central America through the tropics, there are lots of other screech owls. There's tropical screech owl,
really?
Vermiculated screech owl. There's all these different screech owls. I mean, there you go into the Andes in Colombia and Ecuador,
it's just
and Peru.
Their call
and
that's a little different.
The calls are often different. Some of them don't have ears. You know, they start getting more different as you go south, but.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of different kinds of screech owls, and we have three here in North America. There's a whiskered screech owl that you'd get in the Southwest, and then in Texas you can get both.
Wow.
There's Eastern and Western, depending on what part of Texas you're in. But they're such fun little birds.
Yeah,
they're easy to call in. They're interactive. They're easy to see when you call them in because they'll fly across the road and you know you can get your flashlight on them. They're a lot of fun.
Yeah, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Pam is giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Pam.
Oh, this is Pat.
Oh, Pat. Hi, Pat.
So close.
Hi. I've had a problem for a while with two male turkeys that have hung around our apartment since the spring, and one of them is very abusive to the other, and I feel really bad for the younger one. It's like an older male and a younger male, and I don't know if there's any way I can help that younger one from being abused all the time.
No, I mean, it's just hard being a younger male and across many, many species, not just birds. And turkeys are kind of violent, really. If you look at the back of their legs, they have spurs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you think of cockfights and that kind of thing. Well, turkeys have those, and those spurs get bigger with age, and they will fight. They will straight up kung fu fight with those things. Mm. I mean, I have the story that I've probably told on the air before where I heard this sound. This was in Wellfleet, on the ocean side of Wellfleet, probably late winter. And I heard this sound that sounded like somebody using a nail gun, but this neighborhood was absolutely abandoned. There was nobody anywhere. Like, why do I hear a nail gun? And it turned out it was two fighting turkey males, and it was the sound of their legs smashing against each other. It was just like echoing through the neighborhood. And so, they have some pretty serious fights. And eventually that younger male will get older and will be a better fighter and will have a better chance at females. But, it's not something people need to be intervening in. Yeah.
Is there a reason why these two males would have been alone all? They've been here since spring.
I really can't figure out turkey social structure and hierarchy because I feel like every time I see a flock, it has a different number of birds in it. I think, here's our five turkey flock at the feeders again. And then all of a sudden there's 12.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes down to three. And I'm like, what is going on? So I really have no clue. I know you get these, certainly the flocks are getting bigger now as different broods basically come together, and you can get flocks in the 60s, 70s, or even more. You get these super flocks that form in the winter, and then they break apart in the spring, and certainly the females go off and nest. These little sub-flocks that kind of come and go, I don't really know what's going on, especially this time of year.
Yeah. Pam, thanks for the phone. Pat, thanks for the phone call. You know, we got a new doorbell. We got one of those Ring doorbells that has the video camera on it. And, you know, so it tells you on your phone when there's motion at your front door. And the other day, it was like 12 turkeys in the front yard. I never even noticed turkeys in my yard before. And I wouldn't have known they were there if I didn't have that doorbell.
Interesting.
Like, yeah, just kind of. I don't know, feeding on
something.
Did they
try to break in?
No, they did not.
Good.
They just were eating something on the lawn. I don't know what they were getting.
Doing turkey things.
Exactly. All right, so who has hummingbirds? Anybody still have hummingbirds around?
Oh, I don't know. We were supposed to ask the listeners.
Oh.
Does anyone have hummingbirds?
Yeah, okay.
I lost mine. I'd have to look up the date. You know, I had them after mid-September is usually when we expect to lose our hummingbirds. But I've had them as late as early October, meaning our local ruby-throated hummingbirds.
Right. And but so, we could see other hummingbirds now, right?
So we're getting into the period where you could see other hummingbirds. And so like a rufous hummingbird from the Pacific Northwest that goes off track, and instead of, like a western kingbird, instead of going to western Mexico where it's supposed to winter, it takes a wrong tack and ends up on Cape Cod. And that happens every year, too. But we're also still in the period where there could be late ruby-throated hummingbirds. And especially, we just had some really intense south winds. We have a couple different periods of intense south winds in the last couple of weeks. And that will bring things back. So if a ruby-throated hummingbird could have tried to leave and gotten south and then ended up back here. And that happens sometimes. And I think that explains some of the later records that we get. But you get a lot of questions about when do I take my feeders down? And I say, you know, I always say the same thing. You don't take your feeders down. You keep them up in case either a rare one comes up or a ruby-throated gets blown back north. And, you know, then your feeder's still up and keep it clean and everything like that. Mm-hmm. But keeping your feeder up and I also go... I buy these annual plants, which, you know, I'm not that big into annual plants, but there are some that you can get bargain basement prices right now, like $3 for a pineapple sage. And you get a few pineapple sages, put them in some part of your raised bed that doesn't have anything productive in it right now, sunny spot, and that'll bloom through November. And if an interesting hummingbird comes around, it'll come to your yard if you've got pineapple sage. It's little tubular kind of reddish flowers that hummingbirds really like. And if you have a community garden plot, you know, spend $9 and put a few pineapple sages in there, and you could end up with a rare hummingbird. But the hummingbirds leave, right? So my yard, I had two full feeders. They still had flowers on the butterfly bushes that came with my house. There's this big wall of mature, like old growth butterfly bushes that came with my house. And that's where the hummingbirds were spending most of their time in mid-September. And then they're gone.
Yeah.
They're gone because they leave at a certain time based on day length and their, you know, their instincts, and they leave. They're not going to stick around because your feeder is full, and that's, people worry about that for some reason, but it's not how migration works.
No, there's something that internal, they just go, yep, time to go.
Right. I mean, you know, the warblers leave and there's still plenty of insects. They're responding to an internal clock, and you're not really going to be able to do much to affect that.
So if you have hummingbirds, we would love to hear about it. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I want to go to monarchs for me. You mentioned the monarch butterflies. And this year, I think I mentioned before, we've taken some of the caterpillars off of the milkweed, and we've got a butterfly house, and we've released four. So we've had four.
Nice.
And but you know what? I was watching one of them. The first one got released. I wasn't home, so I missed that one. And then the next one that we released, which was a couple weeks ago, this butterfly, it was almost like, hey, I can fly. It was like just all over the yard, swooping down. Like it flew down near my head. Like I was like, is this monarch just saying, hey, thanks for helping me make it to butterfly stage? But I mean, just watching, it was like this pure joy almost. This
reveling in its new wings.
Look at, I can fly.
Right. And can you imagine, you know, what it must be like metamorphosing from a caterpillar, a little grub of a thing, into that, and going through that process where they crawl out of the, they break out of the chrysalis, and then there's still this like weird, like crumpled up homunculus thing, but they have to pump fluid through their wings, and they, you know, slowly the wings straighten out, and then, you know, they catch some sun and dry out, and then they're off, and it must feel great, to the extent that an insect can feel great.
Well, it's funny, the last one I released yesterday, this was the scraggler, I guess, the last little one, and I just opened up the, I left him out in the yard and opened up the butterfly house, and it was a long time. I kept going back looking. He was still there. Maybe it was maybe an hour before he actually kind of flew up onto another plant.
No, you know, they'll take their time.
Yeah.
But yeah, you don't want to rush it.
Flying around, I was like, "Oh, look at this! This is what fun!"
Right. If they take off before they can fly right, then they're going to get eaten.
Yeah.
And yes, they're poisonous, and yes, their orange and black is a warning coloration. But the birds still have to remind themselves. You get some young blue jay will eat one.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad this one. So they're still none of mine got eaten, at least that I saw.
And when they winter in Mexico, so they go to these cool spruce fir forests in central Mexican highlands, right? They're not going to the tropics to sip Mai Tais by the beach, you know. It's very strange. They go to winter in cool mountains where they don't really do much. They hang from the trees, and though they're poisonous, there are two species of birds that either can handle the poison or they eat certain parts of them. But they just gorge themselves on these monarchs. There's black-headed grosbeak, which is a bird you can find in the western U.S., and one of the Central American orioles. I'm forgetting which one. They're not totally impervious to predators just because they have concentrated the poisonous cardiac glycosides that are in the milkweed plants. They concentrate that. That's what they're doing as a caterpillar, is concentrating those poisons so they're poisonous as an adult. But it doesn't give them 100% protection.
Yeah. So I was wondering, because that last one that I released yesterday, I kept thinking, when is this thing going to, you know, come out? Because is it going to be too late? Is it going to be too cold? And luckily, the weather's been pretty nice. But, you know, will that butterfly just all of a sudden decide, I'm out of here because it's time to go? Or, you know, how late do they?
This is the they're not all going to make it. And certainly there's a lot of, you know, ones that emerge too late are less and less likely to make it. but enough of them make it over time that it sustains the population. But yes, this is the generation now, and it has been for weeks anyway, or a month or so. This is the generation that somehow knows it has to go to Mexico, even though the previous three or four generations were all programmed to fly north and breed. This generation does not mate, does not lay eggs. It just flies to Mexico. And then these monarchs that you're releasing, whatever, recently in the last couple of weeks or whatever, if they make it to Mexico, the monarch that'll make it back to your yard next June or July is going to be the great-great or great-great-great grandchild of the one you released. That's what's so mind-blowing about it, is that it's not like bird migration where, you know, that...
They go back and forth,
right,
yeah.
That yellow warbler that nested in the neighborhood comes back the next year. No, it's a multi-generational migration, which it's just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's really fun to just watch them trying out those wings for the first time.
Yeah.
Really, it's kind of a magical experience. It really is. All right, let's talk to Bill, who's calling from Truro. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hello.
I've got a question about looking ahead of the weather forecast for later this week, and there's a sizable ocean storm predicted, and I'm wondering how that might affect the migration this time of year.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things, that's one of the reasons it's hard to be a bird. And that's actually one of the things that came up in that, you know, we've lost 29% of our individual birds, or 3 billion birds study. And it's one of the kind of subtle ways that climate change can have an impact is more frequent hurricanes and coastal storms knocks down more migrants. So all of these billions of songbirds that are migrating out of the northern hemisphere into the southern, into the kind of lower latitudes, into the Central America and South America, they are often over the ocean where they're at the mercy of winds and storms. They can go around them and, you know, they have their ways, but these storms do kill a lot of migrants, especially small birds. Warblers and things that are trying to migrate out over the water. And so, yeah, hurricanes can be a problem. They can also bring birds to places they're not supposed to be. And, you know, birders like that, when you get tropical birds that end up here because of a storm that went up the coast, or, you know, songbirds that aren't normally here that get deposited here by these storms. There's all kinds of things that can happen. But yeah, they also do result in a lot of mortality. And bird, especially in their first year, birds suffer a lot of mortalities. Young birds, something like 80% of them don't make it. And a lot of it is this kind of migration-related mortality.
Yeah. Bill, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Mary says, I have had two females hummingbirds off and on who spar with each other, but this week just one shows up, still filling the feeder every 3 days, unlike summer when the orioles emptied them every day. What a lovely problem to have, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's...
So she's still seeing one.
This is really late. Yeah, October 8th is pretty late, so that's interesting. But if they've been there all along, yeah, I'm sure they're ruby-throated. Yeah. If you're an interesting hummingbird, would look a little different typically than, you know, a ruby-throated female is just green on top, white underneath, and that's typically what you would see. But the rare ones from out west that could start showing up soon tend to have rufous on them in various places, like on the flanks. And at the base of the tail, sometimes it's subtle, but if you see that, like a clear rufous patch on the sides or somewhere on the tail, and that's going to be one of the interesting ones, like a rufous hummingbird, or there's even more rare potential species like an Allen's hummingbird, or Calliope has been out here a few times, and so they all tend to have rufous in different places. Yep. Yeah, so keep an eye out.
Yeah, keep an eye out. All right, Patricia is giving us a call. Good morning, Patricia.
Oh, good morning. And this has been a very interesting program this morning, particularly to me. I live on the shore of Buzzards Bay, and I've noticed a real decline in the bird population just overall. And I have two questions. The first one would be regarding that. Do you think that the highs and lows that we have in the sky would be affecting migration routes? I know little about this.
Mm-hmm.
When we have fronts.
Oh, okay. Pressure, high and low pressure?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, yeah, they're very aware of that, and they use the fronts to help them. I mean, and the fronts bring in certain winds that are either favorable or not favorable to migration. And so, yes, they're reading all of that, and all of that affects bird migration. So, you know, here in New England, cold fronts tend to bring us birds because the bulk of the birds are to our north and west. And so cold fronts tend to come with winds out of the north and west, and so they tend to bring us birds. The birds like to migrate on nights with sort of light north winds that give them a little bit of a tailwind, but not so strong that they end up places they don't want to go. And so in the spring, they like southwest winds tend to bring us birds because the birds are all south and west of us in the spring, and they're coming north, and they like those tailwinds because it helps them save energy. Survival for migratory birds is all about saving energy. And they're very aware of all of that, and they're deciding whether or not to migrate based on winds and fronts and things like that. Yes.
What was the second question?
The second question was apropos of something you said much earlier, and that was the decline of starlings and sparrows, mm-hmm. and that the starlings were unwelcome because they occupy territory that other birds would prefer to be here. And I was curious as to if the starlings disappeared, and maybe some of the sparrows, we can't not assume, can we, that bluebirds will suddenly appear and some of the species that have been pushed out for a number of years will suddenly discover us again?
Well, a couple things. Starlings aren't going anywhere. Just because there's been a decline or an apparent decline doesn't, you know, they're not going extinct. They're dirt common still. Mm-hmm. So, keeping things in perspective is important. And the other thing is bluebirds are already back, and they're back because people love them, and we've put up houses for them, and it's mostly house sparrows that have been a problem, I think, with bluebirds. but starlings do occupy cavities that our native cavity nesters would use, and certainly have negative pressure on their populations. But bluebirds are doing great, in large part because humans have sort of taken to them and put up all these houses and kept house sparrows out of them and kept track of them and cleaned them out and all that stuff. We love bluebirds. And so, and the other reason bluebirds are doing better is the return of beavers, of course. And this is one of my favorite kind of everything is interconnected kind of story. And so beavers were basically trapped out of Massachusetts in the colonial era. And as they've come back, they're such habitat engineers. So they will, they'll dam a stream and form a little pond, and that pond will kind of flood a little bit of forest and kill some trees. And then woodpeckers will make cavities in those dead trees for nesting and then abandon them, and then those cavities will be available for other cavity nesters, and things like bluebirds and tree swallows will then nest in these cavities in these wetlands. And then eventually they don't maintain the dam anymore, and it goes back to a stream and this lush meadow. We call it a beaver meadow. But anyway, when they kill those trees by flooding, great blue herons come in and nest in those dead trees. Hooded mergansers and wood ducks can nest in them while they're flooded. So beavers have an impact on a lot of other species, including bluebirds. And so I think to some extent, as beavers have come back onto the landscape, that's created some natural nesting habitat for bluebirds, in addition to all the help they've gotten from people.
Good to know. I didn't know that.
Yes, thank you very, very much. It's very interesting.
Yeah, Patricia, thanks for the questions. Appreciate that. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Joan is giving us a call from East Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. Mark, you have a great horned owl down in your neck of the woods. It's over by the golf course.
Mm.
And my three catbirds left Sunday night, and that's it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is the time of year when catbirds are exactly that, slipping out overnight.
Sunday afternoon, the three of them chowing down on the grape jelly.
Yep.
And then Monday, didn't hear a peep, didn't see them. And I've got a lot of reptiles moving around in my neighborhood right now. I've got a milk snake.
Really?
And a little mud turtle. Where that came from, I haven't a clue.
Mud turtle?
It came across, it must have come out of the cranberry box over the hill behind me, but that took a long walk.
We don't have,
only about 2 inches long.
We don't have mud turtles. We have musk turtles that are pretty uncommon.
It had a round dome-shaped shell.
Yeah. Dark,
and bright, shiny black.
Pointy little snout.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably a musk turtle, and they're not that common. They're more common as you go west on the... I tend to hang out on the outer Cape where we don't have very many milk snakes or musk turtles. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I haven't seen a musk turtle in years.
Wow. Joan, you're so observant. Joan is so observant.
Geez, zippity-doo-dah over there in East Harwich.
Yeah, that's interesting. All right, Joan, thanks for the phone call. So the catbirds are gone? Is that
No. But they're leaving.
They're leaving, okay.
Right, so this is the time of year when they're, you know, like most songbirds, they're nocturnal migrants, so they slip away at night, right. And the next day they're not there.
Yeah, I really like the catbirds. I had a catbird nest this summer.
How can
you
not?
It was awesome. No, they're great. All right, John has got a question for us. He says, this was the first year in over 30 years that I did not see any ruddy turnstones migrating through a beach I frequent on Nantucket Sound. Is there any data showing a decline in this species?
Yes. I talked to a shorebird expert I know a few years ago, and I was with one of my seasonal staff who was asking about potential graduate projects. And, you know, beyond red knots, he was asking, you know, what's the next thing? What should we be looking at? And he said, ruddy turnstones. And so there's a suite of shorebirds that nest in the really high Arctic, and ruddy turnstones are among them. And these are the birds that are really on the front lines of climate change in the early stages of it, because climate change is happening much more severely in the high latitudes now in the Arctic. And so there's a lot of potential for things to get screwed up for them in terms of resources not being available at the right time when they have a very short breeding season, very, very short. They have one chance at a successful nest. And if things are going haywire up there because of climate change in terms of snow, late snow pack and things like that, then they're going to be declining, and they already are declining. Mm-hmm. But in terms of why you didn't see them in one particular neighborhood, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm still seeing them in the normal places, but they're one to keep an eye on, definitely. Mm-hmm. Anything that nests in the high Arctic, those are species to keep an eye on because of climate change impacts especially.
Mm-hmm. All right, John, thanks for the question. Ken is giving us a call from Kingston. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. How are you all?
Great.
Good.
I would love listening to your show. I have a question about woodpeckers. Mm-hmm. So I've got a very tall house with barn board on the side of it, and woodpeckers are only in one corner, and they are literally just chopping the wood apart. It's like 25 feet in the air. When I get up on a ladder, it's very dangerous. I've gone as far as removing my regular bird feeder from the area because they were eating what I had in the bird feeder. And I figured I was keeping them that way. And unfortunately, I love birds, but they're still there, even without the bird feeder.
Yep.
And I just didn't know if there was a way that I could possibly, you know, stop them from doing it. Someone said, well, there's bugs in the house. I don't think there is.
Right. They're just doing it out of spite. Don't they know that you like birds? That's the thing. They do it to my house too. And come on, me.
Well, I heard it was because it's a territorial thing, and there used to be a big spruce tree next to the house, which they would, you know, bite, you know, work on the house and then go to the spruce tree.
Yeah.
And someone else takes a turn. So the tree was kind of rough, so I got rid of that. But
the
still they're there.
The loud drumming is a territorial thing, but chipping away at your wood is probably looking for food. And really, all you can do is, if it's in a really localized area, then tack up some bird netting to physically keep them away. I mean, they might just move to another part of the house, but that's where you start.
Okay.
Really?
You think it's possibly carpenter ants?
Oh, I don't know.
This time of year, they shouldn't be. I mean, they shouldn't be. You know, well, the carpenter ants shouldn't be active this time of year.
Carpenter ants and carpenter bees are often what they're looking for. But you would know. So when it's carpenter bees, the carpenter bees make like a tunnel,
round holes. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and so then the woodpeckers will expose the underlying tunnel that you couldn't see. So they'll open that up, and so then you'll see this kind of long oval hole, which is where the larval chambers were of the carpenter bee, and the woodpeckers will expose those. If you're not seeing that, if they're just kind of, you know, chipping around here and there, they're probably just searching. I don't know that it means you have carpenter ants. It just means you have annoying woodpeckers.
Yeah. I mean, it's the you work for a week putting up boards in a dangerous ladder, and a month later, there's new holes.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I mean, just try.
My wife's after me, like, don't you get up on the ladder anymore.
So. Yeah. I mean, and this is like Wildlife Hotline 101, kind of like, what do I do? And there's you look it up, and there's all these things, and we have stuff on the Mass Audubon website, you know, and people have tried different things like hanging Mylar strips and things like that. And I've been to places where I hear people playing like distress calls to try to keep the woodpeckers away, and that's no fun for anybody, especially your neighbors. I wouldn't want my neighbor.
Hire owls. It doesn't do anything.
Yeah,
you can hire
some owls. Yeah, hire actual owls would be the best thing to do. Yeah. But really, like bird netting to keep them off of that specific area, and it's not going to be that visible from down below. I don't think it's it's kind of like that fine black netting.
Yeah. Yep, I could live with that for a while if it stays the house.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go give it a try, John. Hopefully that'll work for you.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thanks very much.
Appreciate
it. That was Ken.
Oh, Ken. I'm sorry. Yeah. Got my
calls. Yeah,
we had John was the email before.
It's hard to keep track.
I know, right? And it's,
Kingston. I wonder, you can't hear us in Kingston.
Yeah, you can.
Maybe he's listening online.
No,
South. I lose the signal by the time I get to the middle of Plymouth.
Maybe.
All right.
Anyway, so you had an interesting experience with a photo. So when a bird photo is not what it seems.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, tell us about that.
I was unpopular on Facebook briefly. And so I did this dirty trick where somebody I know, Tasia Blau, who's a marine biologist, and she's living in Brewster, and she sent me these pictures that I was like, oh, my God, this is a great trick question. And so it's pictures of these strange bird in her backyard, and I posted them online on the Cape Cod Birders Facebook group as a quiz. I just put a quiz. I know what it is. I have all the advantage. I've seen 15 photos of this bird from all these different angles, and I just put this one incredibly deceptive photo of this bird up there at this angle, and it makes it look exactly like a shrike. Mm-hmm. And shrikes are rare. Birders get excited about shrikes. It's too early for any kind of it's not the time of year when you would see a shrike. Northern shrikes show up later, like November at the earliest.
So did you have everybody saying, where is this? I have to see it.
Loggerhead shrikes are incredibly rare. And so I put up this quiz, and I know everyone's going to think it's a shrike. The bird is, in fact, a chickadee that is a partial albino with this crazy pattern of white. Like, there's white on the back and parts of the it comes out looking exactly like a shrike. And
isn't
it
that funny?
And it was such a teachable moment thing. I could not resist doing it. And of course, everybody is saying, it's a shrike. And then I posted the other photo of you, where you just see it's a leucistic chickadee sitting on a bird bath. And I was getting like very experienced birders who are on the Avian Records Committee being like, I think you were the one who's been deceived. Are you sure? Those are two different birds.
Yeah,
and I was getting all
funny.
This pushback. I'm like, whoa. And so I put a bigger series of the photos where you clearly see that it's this leucistic chickadee. But it was kind of a lot of experienced birders. You get to know that a single photo can be really deceptive.
Right.
And you're always like, do you have more photos of this? This looks a little weird, because a single photo can be really lead you down the wrong path and lead to embarrassment. And this was one of those examples.
Yeah.
And people didn't know that it was a leucistic chickadee. There wasn't even, they weren't
Nobody
even thinking
even
about
that.
That.
Well, my father used to say, don't believe anything you hear and only half of what you see. Right?
Yeah, that's right. So I'll try to get permission so we can put those photos on the website so people know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Or you can go to the Cape Cod Birders Facebook group from, I don't know when it was, within the last week.
Yeah.
And you can see people yelling at me. And so this one guy was like, Well, okay, but that's not a proper quiz. You shouldn't have been a leucistic bird. I'm like, I don't know. Yeah. What's a proper quiz? I'm sorry. I didn't meet your definition of what a quiz should be. People are funny on social media.
Yeah. All right. So this is, as we mentioned, top of the show, this is a great time to be out looking for birds. What are some of the hot spots if folks want to check out some migrating
hot spots?
Birds?
Yeah. So we covered some of the general categories earlier of your community gardens and weedy waste places, mm-hmm. and gravel pits and things like that. There's a place like that in East Ham. Everybody goes that we affectionately call the Stump Dump because it's a place where, landscapers and tree companies and towns bring all this kind of tree waste and brush and things like that and pile it up. And that's great habitat for sparrows. And then there are all these like compost mounds and things like that that grow up in all kinds of, like everything that grows on those mounds is food for birds this time of year. All these smart weeds and foxtail grass and pokeweed fruit. And so it's just full of birds. You go in there and like a flock of 75 chipping sparrows just gets up and starts scattering everywhere, coming out of one of these mounds like clowns out of a clown car. And there's invariably interesting stuff like blue grosbeaks and some of the things I mentioned earlier, dick sissels. So those are always worth going to.
What about places like Crane and Peterson's Farm?
Oh, yeah. Any like open, brushy, sunny place can be good. certainly marshes. There's still shorebirds around. Still be checking your beaches and your marshes. Different bayside and oceanside vantage points will have migrating scoters and eiders now. Loons are going to be starting to migrate, things like red-throated loons. Common loons are definitely on the move. I've been seeing them. You'll look up every once in a while, and you'll just see a common loon, 700 feet up, just flying over. So a lot of things are on the move now. But
Race Point
and Hatches Harbor are good. We did a walk there this weekend with a group. It was pretty good. Farms like Cape Cod Organic Farm has been hosting some interesting stuff. People have been turning up Connecticut warblers, which is a species I still have not seen on Cape Cod. Very rare migrant, breeds in like spruce bogs and places like Minnesota and Wisconsin and Canada, and not a big population overall globally, and a rare migrant, and people have turned them up a few different places in Barnstable, and they tend to be in kind of weedy spots.
I have one more email here. Joe says, I was walking my 11-pound Jack Russell in the backyard about a year ago, and he suddenly started barking in panicked distress. I ran to the area where he was about 10 feet into the woods, and he came out with 5 holes in his backside that required surgery to repair. I heard nothing when I went to his rescue. I hear great horned owls all the time and wonder if one may have been the attacker.
That's not related to what I was rambling aimlessly about a minute ago.
We're changing direction.
Well, good. Thanks for saving me. Who knows?
Yeah,
holes in the back.
Yeah,
of
but something,
Jack
like
Russell.
Something pecked on him or something, right? Or
well,
I don't know.
Well, no, yeah, that's more likely to be talons. Like I think he's
talons.
Suggesting.
Yeah. Oh, like tried to pick him up and take him away or something.
Maybe. Or just sort of attacked it.
That could have been any big raptor, though, right? It could be a great horn. It could be maybe even a red-tailed hawk.
Red-tailed hawk.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of bald eagles around now.
Yeah. So guess we don't know.
Yeah. I have a chihuahua. I really have to watch it when Timmy's out walking around.
Oh, is Timmy a chihuahua? I didn't realize
he's
that.
He's a chihuahua. He's an 11 or 12-pound chihuahua, depending on the
gotta
month.
Keep your eye on that little guy. All right.
Yeah.
All right, Bird News, second Tuesday every month. Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. As always, thank you, Mark.
All right, catch you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.